This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Attorney General Roy Cooper files an antitrust case against Carolina's Healthcare of Charlotte. Alma Adams wins the right to run again in her district despite a redrawing of the voter map. And Robert Pittenger squeaks past Mark Harris, maybe, on the Republican side in the race for Congress. Ron Kimball is named interim Charlotte City Manager. Governor McCrory vetoes a coal ash bill. So what happens next? And efforts are still alive to stop the toll lanes on I-77. The fight has now moved to the North Carolina Senate, and Cam Newton says the dab is dead. Those and other stories on our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. Welcome back. Hillary Burns, staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, is here. And for the first time ever on this edition of the show, Tim Funk, political news and faith and values writer for the Charlotte Observer. I'm not sure how those two go together, Tim, but you can explain that on a later edition. Welcome back.
Great.
Let's begin with the news that broke yesterday. Attorney General Roy Cooper and the federal government have initiated an antitrust case against Carolina's Healthcare of Charlotte with an eye towards seeking more competition to lower consumers' health care costs. What is the Attorney General alleging here?
In a nutshell, the Attorney General and the Department of, well, both Attorney Generals, Roy Cooper and the Department of Justice, are alleging that Carolina's healthcare system is using its market power. They say it controls about 50% of the healthcare market in the Charlotte region. And they say they're using their outsized power to influence and force insurance companies to enter into contracts with the hospital system that essentially prevents the insurance company from encouraging its customers, its insured members, from seeking cheaper alternative healthcare treatment at the hospital's competitors.
If you read the story about this in the Observer this morning, the Observer references a previous series of articles it did about the price of health care months ago that got the Attorney General of North Carolina's attention. Are you also saying that you're responsible for starting the ball rolling on this?
Of course. Well, you know, that series by Ames Alexander and Karen Garlow, and the News and Observer also was involved, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. My question is, that was 4 years ago. Now Roy Cooper is running for governor, so I worry that, or I don't worry, but I wonder if that's going to muddy the waters a little bit. And also, they're going after the biggest fish, but there's a lot of other hospitals in
the state. Well, I was going to say, we have Carolina's healthcare system, which is the system in question here, but we also have Novant. They're another hospital system, and there's Carimont. So there is. You don't have to go to Carolina's healthcare system, do you?
But this is all about something called steering, and it is important to point out that it's not just Attorney General Roy Cooper here in North Carolina that is a party to this case. It does include the U.S. District Attorney here. The feds are involved, so it's not just solely a state thing. And what this all deals with is a process called steering. Now, if you're an insurance company, you have a vested interest in making sure that you pay the least amount for claims that are filed by the people who you represent. So steering happens in a perfect world where an insurance company will push you towards a hospital that can offer you the same procedure at a cheaper price. But what's alleged in this suit is that CHS has such a broad it's such a dominant player here. It is over 50% of the market, or around 50% of the market, that they can negotiate with insurance companies that they never steer their patients, their clients, anywhere else. And according to this suit, CHS's own internal consultants have recognized that the hospital chain, and it is a chain, it's one of the largest, you know, nonprofit public hospital chains in America. It has over 40 hospitals. Just hospitals, just in the Carolinas alone, that they are receiving a premium, meaning they are paying, they're getting paid more than comparable places because of their market share, because the suit alleges of this steering to make sure that the patients stay inside CHS regardless of cost.
With that in mind, the suit also claims that insurers have tried to get out of these contracts, but the insurers claim that they can't, because the Carolina's healthcare system is such a dominant force here, they can't afford to lose their business. So,
Now here's what Roy Cooper had to say about the suit yesterday.
When you consolidate and when you have a larger and larger share of the market, you have more power. And in this particular situation, I think insurance companies believe that they've got to make sure that this company is included in their coverage for their patients.
Let's talk about steering for a second, because I don't recall ever being steered to a doctor or a hospital system by an insurance company.
Well, Carolina's healthcare system is claiming this is about language, that this is the language in their contracts, and that's the problem, that other hospitals use the same language. So I would say that's the question. Is it about language? Do other hospitals use similar wording in their contracts?
Well, let's take that at face value, and I actually think that it is a practice that you do see in other places. But the question isn't whether or not this exists anywhere else. The question is whether or not it is legal, or given your control of a market, whether it becomes antitrust activity, whether it becomes an active
monopoly.
Well,
is this just about the hospitals, or is it also about the fact that Carolina's healthcare system, as well as Novant and other hospital systems, also are the back office, essentially, for a lot of private doctor practices? You'll see their signs all over the place, and that's because the doctors have come in and said, hey, we want to be doctors, you run our business.
It's actually it's a little bit different than even that. There are a lot of cases where, in fact, doctors' practices are bought up by hospital chains.
Right.
And therefore they become employees of the hospital. I mean, there was actually a suit, I believe it was last year, that was more of a national scope, but it really focused on it was a hospital called Park Ridge Hospital, which is in Hendersonville, and it was part of the Adventist chain, and they had bought these practices, and they insisted that those doctors refer all of their patients for expensive procedures, and in that suit, which was settled for $115 million, and it is not the same thing. I want to be clear that that is being alleged here, but in that particular suit, they were saying that they were referring patients for unnecessary tests, and they had to be done at the Adventist Hospital, and that's how they were making their money.
And when I talked with Roy Cooper yesterday, he made clear that this is a problem and a thing that's happening everywhere as the industry consolidates, and he said it'll be interesting to test. This case is kind of a test to see if the courts are going to say ultimately this is an okay thing or this is a thing that we need to stop.
This complaint also accuses CHS of blocking consumers from receiving information about the cost and quality of CHS services. On what is that based? Do we know?
More contract language that the state and federal authorities contend that CHS puts in contract language with the insurance companies. It says the insurance companies will not publish the actual prices that they're paying to CHS. So in effect, blocking consumers from seeing the actual prices that are being paid for their health care.
You can't go on Blue Cross Blue Shield and find out what a procedure costs?
Not at all places. You know, there's a growing movement for more transparency. Basically, a growing movement when it comes to healthcare costs, that it's treated like any other product or any other service where it comes with a price tag and you can comparison shop. But it's a much more difficult thing to do than it is to, say, buying a car or buying a coffee maker. And what they're trying to do is get it to be a little bit more transparent. But again, and we have to say this is all alleged in the complaint.
Right.
Alleged in the complaint is that CHS would not allow that or would not let these insurance companies steer patients, steer their clients, their customers, to cheaper facilities, even to get the same procedure. Now, how was CHS able to muscle them? It's simple. If they don't take your insurance, if you are Blue Cross, if you are Aetna, if you are Cigna, or if you are United Healthcare, which are the four insurance companies in this suit, and you cannot send your customers, your clients, to CHS. The suit alleges that you have no business model in the region. That CHS is that dominant a player.
Wow.
So they have to play ball with CHS. And as Hillary pointed out, they tried to negotiate away these steering clauses. The insurance companies did, but they continually failed because CHS allegedly would not give.
Did North Carolina initiate this, or did they go into partnership with the federal government on this? Who came to whom?
It sounds like the Attorney General's office, Roy Cooper's office, started looking at this, and then they went. That's my take, is then they went to the Department of Justice, who then, and, you know, I couldn't get a straight answer of exactly how long the Attorney General's office had been looking at this, but he made the point, look, these cases, and it's true, involve a lot of paperwork and a lot of investigating and take a long time to bring to fruition like this. So it's taken years.
So is this coincidental that this is occurring during Roy Cooper's campaign for governor, in which he looks like he's riding in on a white horse for the consumer?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not a bad thing for him, right? But this has taken so long. It's possible that he's, you know, just such a great planner that he's been planning this for for so long. But, you know, I think it's good for him, but I don't know that that's the reason.
What has been the response of the hospital system?
Well, at one point I wanted to bring up the North Carolina Hospital Association for the state. They said yesterday that hospitals are only a piece of this, and we need to look at insurers too. And that's a point that I thought was interesting, because insurers don't have a clean track record. In 2010, Blue Cross Blue Shield came under intense criticism in the state for owning so much market share and driving up costs for patients. So I think that there are multiple pieces to this too.
Yeah, and directly answer your question, CHS's response has been, this is what other people do as well. Mm-hmm. And again, that's what's being tested here for the first time, is this illegal, anti-competitive activity, or is this perfectly legit?
So the decision here could be groundbreaking.
Absolutely.
As we go forward.
It will be.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the results of the North Carolina primary, which of course was on Tuesday, and the I-77 toll road bill to kill it is still alive, kinda. We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Hillary Burns, staff writer with the Charlotte Business Journal. Tim Funk with the Charlotte Observer. And Nick Oxner with WBTV News. This Tuesday, although nobody voted, was the primary, the recap of the redo of the primary. Alma Adams handily won in her redrawn 12th congressional district in the Democratic primary. And in the 9th district, Republican incumbent Robert Pittenger at this moment has squeaked past his closest challenger, Mark Harris, though Harris is reportedly seeking a recount. So any surprises in either contest?
I was surprised a little bit how easily Alma Adams
won.
I mean, I think she, of course, is from Greensboro. She moved to Charlotte when they redrew the district. She ran
allegedly,
against,
according to Nick Oxner over here, who followed her with a camera.
I think she votes here. So, but she had two formidable challengers from Charlotte, Malcolm Graham and Tricia Cotham. But she won with 42% of the vote. She would have avoided a runoff.
How do you figure that out? How does that happen when you have two local, well-known people like Malcolm Graham, former state senator, running against her in a district that really wasn't home until 5 minutes?
I think it was the hats, frankly.
It's the power of money and advertising in politics. Anyone who's ever run a political race can tell you that. Still, you can knock on all the doors you want. You can attend all the rubber chicken dinners you want. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to how much ads are you putting on TV. Mm-hmm. Alma Adams and her hats had that great ad, and she just blanketed the airwaves with that ad. And she raised, $600,000? Because she had the power of incumbency, and she was getting a
She outspent her outraised her opponents 4-1, but yeah. Pittenger outraised him 5-1, and he barely got in. I think her hat ad was brilliant, and I also think she was careful to point out that she brought money for the Blue Line to Charlotte. She brought money, federal money, for the airport tower. I think she just, and people liked her, I think. And so I think Robert Pittenger needs to get a hat.
As you, she won, as you said, with 42% of the vote to former State Senator Malcolm Graham's 29% and Tricia Cotham's 21%. Alma Adams credits her win to her commitment to serve her constituents.
It's unfortunate that my opponent's focus seemed to be on me and where they thought I was sleeping. As I said before, people are looking for someone that they can trust, who will make a commitment to serving them, and that's what they saw in me.
Do you think that's accurate in a district that really didn't know her?
I think actually it had more to do with, people don't remember this, but she was endorsed by Mayor Jennifer Roberts. She was endorsed by Vilma Leek and Kelly Alexander and James Ferguson. So real power players in the Charlotte area, and I think that helped make a difference as well.
And I think people did know her, and she also she got a lot of publicity when she was the 100th woman in Congress last year. So I think that she's a well-known name. So it's not like a new person.
And the fact that they redrew her district, that got some publicity, and the fact that she was looking for a place to live in this district, even though she didn't have to. Mm-hmm. And then you followed her to Greensboro, 2 weeks ago?
Yes. Yeah, we did.
And ambushed her, did you?
An ambush is when someone doesn't know that you're coming. Her campaign had told us they weren't going to talk with us an hour before we met her at her home, and so they decided not to talk with us, to schedule a time to talk to me, and so we just took it upon ourselves.
Okay. In the 9th district, at last report, Robert Pittenger was ahead of Mark Harris by about 142 votes. There were still some uncounted votes a couple of days ago because some ballots.
Provisional ballots.
Provisional mail.
Absentee.
Like the 12th district, the Ninth District, I believe, also has new boundaries, and Pittenger said that his narrow margin of potential victory was because of that.
They don't know me. I was working in Washington, D.C., and my opponents were able to campaign every single day, and so they didn't get to know me. And I understand that, respect that. And so I don't think they rejected me. They just didn't know me. And so we'll get a chance to get to know me.
He was on television a lot in Charlotte and in Monroe and Fayetteville. Right. I don't know if that's true, that they didn't know him. I do think there is a friends and neighbors sort of thing in certain parts of North Carolina where if people do know you, right. That helps. I mean, Todd Johnson, the former Union County Commissioner, carried Union County and actually carried five of the eight counties.
In fact, the only county that Pittenger won was Mecklenburg County.
And he came in last in every county except Mecklenburg. So I think he did do some campaigning as well. He had there were other things involved. Sue Myrick, who held the seat for 18 years, went out of her way to try to beat him. She did robocalls. She did
endorsed Mark Harris.
Endorsed Mark Harris. And
explain that.
I don't think anybody can yet. I mean, Pittenger and Sue Myrick used to be quite close. I mean, they were definitely political allies. She basically just said that Mark Harris was now her choice for, you know.
Well, she endorsed when they first before they redrew the district, she endorsed the guy who was going to run against Pittenger initially. I mean, she was like
something
almost before he announced, she was out there endorsing him.
That's true.
They had bad blood going back many years. We wrote a story about how, you know, back in 2003, she wrote a letter to the editor, 2004, supporting Pittenger when when he became embroiled in a political controversy. But 3 years later, she publicly dissed him and said that he had kind of was telling everybody that he was going to run for Congress and she was going to run for governor and she was going to endorse him. And she just publicly said, I want my picture off your website. You're not on my, you know, campaign list anymore. And he was once one of her biggest contributors.
This was the second time we voted for these people, because we voted for them before back in March, right. and we knew going into this that election, the results of that particular race were going to be thrown out for this primary because they had just redrawn the districts and it was too late to change anything. Did they ever release the outcome of that election?
No, and they never will.
And they never will. So the voter turnout in this election on Tuesday was 7.5%.
Statewide.
Is that a record low?
No.
That's really?
Hardly. Absolutely. Yeah, and actually, to the credit of the people of Mecklenburg County, the vote rate here was slightly higher at 8.3%, which is not necessarily something to crow for, but it is, in fact, at least better than the 7.5% statewide. And keep in mind this. When I spoke with Michael Dickerson, who's the chairman of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections, he was hopeful originally for between 5 and hoping up to 10% because of these, you know, hot contests that you had, congressional races that people know matter, and a Supreme Court seat. So this turnout was actually seen as a good thing.
The candidates, I think, thought it would be 5% because he thought everybody's at the beach, you know, who's going to show up?
Had the turnout been higher, would the results have been different?
Potentially, absolutely. It's always, you never know, because here when you get 8% turnout, 7% turnout, you're getting the really faithful, and it's very easy for campaigns to target those people and make sure they get to the polls. But when you start injecting a bunch of other people, less informed, less motivated voters who are going and picking the guy that they whose name they recognize, you start to inject a lot more uncertainty.
In fact, Mark Harris actually won on Election Day. He was defeated quotation marks by the absentees that came in earlier. So
when will we know the outcome of that?
It's a little unclear. You know, the counties canvass their results next Tuesday, and that's when they'll count a lot of the votes that haven't been counted. But then after that, with the recount, those votes could be not final again.
And Pittenger had two challengers in that race, and nearly twice as many people voted against him as voted for him, and that's something that challenger Mark Harris readily used after the election.
The results that I want you to make sure you understand tonight is that more than 65% of the voters of the new 9th District of North Carolina have rejected the current leadership in the United States House of Representatives.
What does that tell us?
Well, same percent voted, 65% voted against Mark Harris, too. So, I mean, politicians will say what they want to say. But I think the point is that this was sort of a referendum on Washington experience. And a lot of people who are angry at Washington Republicans right. did vote against it.
But there, I do think that I agree completely with what you're saying, Tim. But there's another side to this, which is even though the new voters in the new ninth, which you know used to stretch up through Iredale but now stretches east to the outskirts of Fayetteville, you still, since this is a new district, you still have this feeling of there may be an incumbent, but this is my time voting for this person for the first time.
Right.
So the fact that Todd Johnson, who used to be a Union County Commissioner, won Union County is not a surprise. He is a recognizable name. The fact that you know Mark Harris did really well with the more rural areas is not a surprise. What was a surprise was a point that was alluded to earlier, which is the micro-targeting that was done by the Pittenger camp to make sure that they got just enough votes in Union County where they placed third, that they got just enough votes and then hoped that Mecklenburg would come through. That strategy clearly worked, and as an incumbent, you have the ability to fundraise to make sure that you have the people and the technology to make that happen. 142 votes out of 26,512 cast. 142 votes. That is micro-targeting.
I think he owes it to Myers Park, basically. He lost Matthews and Mint Hill,
yep.
places he represents now, but he did win in the sort of more affluent parts of Mecklenburg.
So Alma Adams now will face Republican Leon Threet. Is that how you say
That's
his name?
Correct.
In the fall, he had 41.79% of the Republican vote. And since this is a new district for Alma Adams, who has lived historically in Greensboro and not in Mecklenburg County, which comprises most of that district now, does that mean that Threet's a threat? Had to say that.
Well, he's more of a threat.
Give me the evil eye.
That's bad for public radio.
It's well done.
He's more of a threat now than he would have been in the old 12th. We are the 12th. We are sitting in the 12th now, and it is still a heavily Democratic district. But now that you actually have it encompass Huntersville and Davidson and Cornelius, and you have still the solid Republican base in South Charlotte. Mm-hmm. He could still be more of a player than we've seen in the past. In the past, it would be easy to say that the Democratic primaries already happened. Let's just go ahead and get on with it and save money on the election. There will be a challenge. Now, whether or not he gets the kind of support that he needs in order to go against a sitting incumbent with a fundraising advantage and a well-known name, we'll have to see.
Look, if enough of the Mecklenburg County establishment says, look, we just don't – all the ones who ran against her in the Democratic primary say, look, we'd rather have someone from here instead of Alma from Greensboro, and they go and they coalesce behind him, it's entirely possible.
Don't hold your breath.
Right. I don't think that would happen, but that's a scenario in which it could.
Well, incumbent Republican Representative Renee Elmers also ran in a redrawn district. This is up around Raleigh. She was endorsed the weekend prior to the election by Donald Trump, who also voiced some robocalls for her. She lost. Was that because of Trump's endorsement,
no.
the fact that she was running against another incumbent, George Holding, who won, or was it her redrawn suburban district?
No, it's a combination of things. I think the story here is not that she lost because of the Trump endorsement. What was interesting is she still lost so big in spite of the Trump endorsement. She's running in a district where that endorsement Trump won that district in the Republican primary. And I think what really the story here is that this Renee Elmers, who was swept in on the grand 2010 Tea Party wave, was just deemed to be too close to the establishment. So quickly, they jettisoned her, and there was a huge amount of money that was spent. I think it was $1.2 million by core Republican groups to oust her and to support her opponent.
She voted for a bipartisan budget that the leadership wanted. She also helped delay a bill about abortion that a lot of conservatives wanted. My reporting indicates that a lot of conservatives are upset with Donald Trump because he did endorse her.
And she was the first sitting member of the House to endorse him, if I remember right.
Yeah, she wrote a piece in Time magazine extolling Trump in the 100 most influential people. They picked Renee Elmers to write a little tribute to him. So, but I don't think it helped him here. And it certainly didn't help her.
In the North Carolina nonpartisan Supreme Court race, incumbent Justice Robert Edmunds was the top vote getter, and his challenger in the fall will be Mike Morgan. This is a nonpartisan race, but Edmunds was outed by the Observer as being a Republican.
Hang on. Edmunds was not outed by the Observer. I was at the Republican State Convention in Greensboro.
Heated rivalry here.
Where he said, no, I don't mean that in that sense. I just mean this is how partisan this race has become, where where he stood on the stage and told all the Republicans that he was the only Republican running in the race, that if he doesn't win, that the Republicans lose control of the state house. I don't mean that in any terms of rivalry. I just mean that he not only outed himself, but it is the key point of his election.
Yeah, it's not a secret.
He's a Democrat, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a secret that Justice Edmonds is a Republican. He's always run as a conservative judge or justice, and so that's the ticket to getting reelected.
Meanwhile, we have 30 seconds here. Pat Cotham, who is on the city council?
That'd be the county commission?
County commission, excuse me. She has endorsed, she's a superdelegate to the Democratic National Convention, and she has endorsed Bernie Sanders, and she did it, I believe, the day that the president endorsed
Hillary
Clinton.
No, she did it actually Monday night.
Yeah, okay, an hour before.
We all knew it was coming. Right, we all knew the Obama endorsement was coming, but she did this. Why?
Good question.
Yep. She supports him. I mean, she seems to find that she is more in line with Bernie Sanders' views on a number of issues. I was actually at Bernie Sanders' rally here covering it when she spoke and spoke grandly about basically Bernie Sanders'
issues.
She
also thinks she can beat Trump more than Hillary.
Okay. We're going to come back and talk about the I-77 tolls, the budget bills that are still going through the state legislature, and some many other things, actually, on the Weekly News Roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, the weekly news roundup with Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Tim Funk from the Charlotte Observer, Hillary Burns, staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about I-77 now because we talked last week about how the North Carolina House overwhelmingly passed a bill to cancel the I-77 toll contract. That bill went to the Senate. You spent some time, I believe, in Raleigh this week, Nick. What are you hearing about the bill's chances for passage in the Senate?
Yeah, we sat down. I talked with Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger for a story that we're going to have on WBTV Monday night at 6. Please tune in and watch, but I'll give you a preview
Shameless plug.
I have serious doubts about whether or not this bill is actually going to make it through the Senate. Berger was still noncommittal on its future. Even when you talk to the bill supporters, folks, Senator Jeff Tartt, others from the Mecklenburg area, they are hopeful that maybe it can get a hearing in committee and the Transportation Committee, which needs to be done by the end of next week if it's going to move forward this session. Mm-hmm. That still remains far from certain. And so while it is in the Senate, I am not sure that it has a very strong future.
It does at least have something of a future. There is a wonderful graveyard in the Senate where if something gets assigned to one particular committee, it's like not even dead on arrival. It was dead before it got there, and that is the Ways and Means Committee. I was stunned to see this not get shifted off to Senator Tom Apodaca's holding tank and actually at least get listed to an actual committee that meets.
Well, that's true, but there's still – and it's there, and I think that is a testament to the fact that they are throwing a bone, I think, to the greater Mecklenburg delegation, mm-hmm. and they recognize that this is a thing. But Senator Berger made a really interesting point that he is more concerned with the appearance of this. He said two things. One, very interesting. He said, look, the future of highways in North Carolina is tolls. And two, he is concerned with the message that canceling this contract would send to companies that they want to do business with to build future toll roads. So
And there are consequences of for the local area for canceling this contract if it is successful, correct?
Yeah, several other projects would get canceled right along with that.
And yet the Observer reported this morning, speaking of toll roads being the paradigm for the future of road building in North Carolina, there's a story in the Observer this morning about the Monroe toll roads being ready to go, essentially.
I haven't read that story
yet. Well, here, let me give you a newspaper. You can look at that.
Had to go on a radio show.
So did I.
You got up earlier than me.
That's probably true. And I had to read the comics.
That's a good story.
Lawmakers want to get a final budget done. And on Governor McCrory's desk by July the 1st, there are, as usual, differences in the budget passed by the House and that passed by the Senate. The House has now rejected the Senate's proposed budget. What happens now?
Said they didn't even need debate, which is rejected.
Although I respect him for that because, let's face it, it would have been just, pro forma stuff anyway. Now, I like to refer to budget season in two waves. There's the actual number season, and now there's the horse trading season. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of fillies that are about to get, argued over and passed back and forth between the House and the Senate. And really what it is at stake here, to boil it down to two simple things, it comes down to teacher pay three things. Teacher pay, cost of living increases for retirees, and overall state pay for state workers. Those are the three biggest sticking points they each budget has very different views on all three of those, and that's where the money is really going to be over. There's one thing I also that I'm interested in to still see if it survives when it comes to the House, and that is a strange environmental provision that is in the Senate budget that deals with nutrient runoff into freshwater streams and reservoirs. And that, you know, the Senate loves to put policy into its budget, or at least recently has loved to put policy points in their budget. House is not so keen on that. It doesn't mean that it won't make it in, but it does mean, it seems at least, that it will be a negotiating point.
That was a sticking point last year, was all the tax policy and finance policy they had. And the House said, we don't want to use this as a policy vehicle. We want this to be a budget vehicle. And so I think you'll see them try to strip that out. But we'll see. Typically, the Senate wields a much stronger hand, more forceful hand in these negotiations. So we'll see.
Meanwhile, the governor has vetoed a bill that would have required Duke Energy to provide a permanent alternative source of clean drinking water to homes affected by contaminated groundwater near Duke-owned coal plants. Why the veto?
Well, the governor says that it is bad for the environment. It is interesting that...
Did he explain that?
Well, he says more than it's bad for the environment. Actually, what it gets down to is it's the panel and the makeup of the panel. The governor really originally sued to stop this law because he said that the legislature had violated the separation of powers, in essence, because it was allowed to, under its own law that it passed, it was allowed to appoint more members than he thought they should have been able to what was called the Coal Ash Commission. He won that case in court, so the court disbanded. He was able to get that commission disbanded. What really this boils down to, and this is one point I found really interesting when it came to Senate Leader Phil Berger, and he says, you know, both the House and the Senate have enough votes to easily override this veto. House seems poised to do it, but Berger is putting the brakes on it in the Senate because he says he wants to avoid a legal battle and try to come up with some form of compromise. That's where we get into what is good or not good for the environment.
Well, no, but I seize on the environment point because I was surprised in his statement announcing his veto. The governor said, look, I think that we can get alternative water sources, and this is some claims that is met with skepticism from the environmental community. But I think that we can get alternative drinking water sources to these affected homes faster without the legislation. And he kind of asserted and implied that that legislation gave Duke far more cover than what DEQ wanted to now enforce. Of course, that would kind of be a change in position from the same DEQ that just months ago said that water was safe to drink in the first place. But it is interesting, too, that Duke is actually now lobbying for his veto to be overridden. And what does that tell us about who Duke thinks they really won?
Observer this morning reprinted an editorial from the News and Observer, I just got rid of it off my phone, darn, which said essentially, if only Governor Pat McCrory's righteous indignation at the legislature's coal ash regulatory bill came out of a desire for stronger regulation that would truly get tough with the governor's former employer, his veto would be welcomed. This is all about a power struggle between the legislature, really, isn't it?
Who's on this commission, who appoints this commission. But also I think the governor has some concerns about deadlines and timetables about when these people could have access to alternative drinking water.
And he's put forth a proposal. Does it differ substantially from the legislature's proposal?
Well, he thinks it's more strict. It is interesting to see. So we talked about DHHS and DEQ, you know, telling these folks it's okay to drink their water just months ago. But then more recently, they came out and issued far more stringent ratings of the dams that would have required Duke to close all of their coal ash dams by 2024, which was actually a more tough and stringent rating system than what anyone expected. So they're starting to take a more hard-lined approach, I think, kind of to my surprise and the surprise of others.
I understand, Nick, that you are reporting today on WBTV that the state pension fund hasn't been performing well for 15 years. It hasn't met the expected rate of return, so there will be no cost of living increases for state retirees. But for years, we have heard that State Treasurer Janet Cowell, who runs that pension fund, has been doing a good job with it. She's been praised for the good job she's done with it. So where's the truth in all of this?
Now it depends on who you're talking to. We reported this last night at 6 o'clock. It's on WBTV.com today. But no, the truth is state employees have really dinged her for these risky, what they say is risky alternative investments that come with much higher fees. They have not given the returns that would be the payoff for using such risky investments. Mm-hmm. And so, look, the numbers last year, the pension fund had 0.3% returns, okay, so virtually no returns. Over the last 15 years, it's not met its expected rate of return, which is about 7%. Mm-hmm. Cal's office says in her 7 years as treasurer, it's returned an 8% return, which her critics say is still less than when you compare it to other funds, still less than what you would have gotten if you'd indexed the funds. And so, you know, folks say that ultimately, if something's not done to get out of these alternative investments, we may run out of money far, far down the road in the pension system.
Okay. Speaking of bankers and money, Hillary, you reported recently on the number of former bankers who are using their skills and expertise as entrepreneurs, which is benefiting Charlotte's startup scene. In fact, you discovered that almost all of the startups here have a former member of the banking industry involved. How many people are we talking about?
That is anecdotal, but I've been covering the startup scene for a year now and talk with people every day, all different kinds of companies, from product companies to tech companies, and it does seem like all of them have roots tied back to the large banks in town. And I just thought that transition must be so interesting given the rigid corporate cultures in these huge financial services institutions. And now these people are working in trendy offices, doing one-man shops that turn into small businesses. Some of them are large businesses now. And people, once I started hearing people's stories about that transition, it was so interesting. I mean, each person had a unique experience, but a lot of them learned how to manage 80-hour work weeks and were able to put in all this time to launch these companies. Others were sick of the regulation at the banks and felt like they couldn't innovate there, so they left to do their own startups. And the stories were so interesting, and now I'm hearing more and more people are continuing to reach out.
How are they helping these what you describe as the blooming startup scene here? Mm-hmm. Is it simply that they're bringing startups usually kind of funky,
yeah,
and they're bringing corporate expertise and stability to the table? Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, I think that's one way. They grew up in the banks in some cases, and they learned best practices. Mm-hmm. One investment banker I talked to saw deals, a plethora of deals in all different industries, so he learned how to buy companies on his own without outside help. That's a really unique skill that he can bring to the table now. So I think the banks are fueling, that is one way, their talent is fueling the startup scene here.
Are they leaving the banks because they're being laid off or because they're sick of it? Or
it really depends. A lot of people I talked to were just sick of it. They are technologists at heart, and they felt they couldn't innovate and create their own product that they could own fully, so they want to do it on their own. Some people were laid off in the recession and went on to do a new venture. So it really depends.
And we were going to talk about this last week, and we ran out of time, because Charlotte's also starting to find its place, you say, on the map as a, is it fintech? Is that
fintech,
how you say?
Yeah, financial technology.
Yeah, as a fintech hub. Mm-hmm. Is that also due to the transition of people out of banking into entrepreneurial areas?
I would argue that, yes, that's a huge advantage Charlotte has compared to other cities. Our startup scene is tied to financial services. The banks employ so many people here, not everyone is suited to be a banker forever. People mm-hmm. are going to leave and start their own companies. And Charlotte is really starting to emerge. People in other cities, people from investors from Silicon Valley are recognizing Charlotte as a fintech hub. And last week we had our first major fintech conference here in Charlotte. It was a really cool event. I was there most of the day.
For the Luddites among us, what does it mean to be a fintech hub? What exactly are we talking about here?
So really, we're talking about the startup community here. So think of Silicon Valley, Austin, D.C., other communities that have entrepreneurial and innovative cultures. That's what it means. Fintech is part of the startup scene here. So it's important, as Brad Feld, who's a famous entrepreneur and investor, said, you need a startup community to stay fresh, because these big companies we rely on aren't always going to be here. They're going to move away, and we're going to need new companies to lead Charlotte.
Minute left. With that minute, Ron Kimball has been named interim Charlotte City Manager to replace Ron Carley on July 1st. Is he in the pipeline to become the permanent replacement?
It's possible. I want to wait and see before I give official judgment. I think he's certainly going to be considered. I think really what you have there is somebody who has been around for quite some time, who has a good understanding of the city's situation and how to run it.
Earlier this week, accident on I-85 at the Catawba River Bridge released bees and yellow jackets from a truck that was transporting both. I understand why they transport bees. We've done a show on it. Why would you transport yellow jackets except to put them in my backyard? Why would you do that?
I wouldn't do that.
Okay. And finally,
as far away as I could.
And finally, and this could be the most critical news of all for all the superstitious people out there who don't want anything with the Panthers to change so that we can repeat last year's remarkable success, Cam Newton has announced yesterday that he is retiring the dab.
Oh, no.
Why?
Well, I think we all knew it was dead with the city council photo. I will leave it at that.
Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV, Tim Funk with the Charlotte Observer, Hillary Burns with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.